Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Kelly Jean Kelly, Ann Ball, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
United States President Donald Trump has threatened to remove millions of people who entered the country illegally as fast as they come in. Trump wrote on Twitter that the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement next week will begin the process of removing the millions of illegal aliens who have illicitly found their way into the United States. The series of comments come as Trump prepares to officially start his re-election campaign Tuesday night. Limiting immigration was a central issue of Trump's 2016 campaign, and he is expected to use the same issue in the upcoming 2020 campaign. The president also suggested that he will soon sign an agreement on migration with Guatemala. The agreement would make Guatemala the country where migrants fleeing El Salvador and Honduras would go to seek asylum instead of the U.S. or Mexico. Trump said the Central American country would become part of efforts to limit migration in the area with a tweet on Monday. Guatemala is getting ready to sign a safe third country agreement, he wrote. A U.S. State Department delegation traveled to Guatemala last week to seek approval for the safe third country policy. If it is signed into law, it might be the first agreement of its kind between the U.S. and a Latin American country. However, Guatemala has not made a public statement that it is ready to complete the deal. In the same tweet, Trump praised Mexico for its effort to deal with migration at its borders. Mexico, using their strong immigration laws, is doing a very good job of stopping people long before they get to our southern border, he wrote. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department had announced plans to freeze some aid money to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. State Department spokesperson Morgan Ortegas said aid already targeted for the three so-called Northern Triangle countries would be provided. However, she said new money would not be provided until the administration is satisfied that these governments are taking clear measures to reduce migration to the U.S. border. Some American lawmakers have urged that the administration not cut aid. They are worried that doing so would make the migration problem worse. The Northern Triangle countries face high crime rates and weak economies within their borders. Veronica Escobar represents the border city of El Paso, Texas, in the U.S. House of Representatives. She said, instead of working with leaders in Central America to stabilize the situation there, the administration is eliminating aid intended to create better conditions that would help keep families home. The human rights group called the Washington Office on Latin America also disagrees with the decision to freeze some aid. The group said cutting all aid to Central America is not the way to build a safer, more prosperous region where people aren't forced to flee. In March, the Trump administration said it would cut aid to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. It noted the president's unhappiness with the three countries' immigration policies. Ortega said that the State Department's decision came after a study of current policies. She said that aid, in the form of grants and contracts that had been provided for earlier, would continue at current levels. Aid supporting justice and security issues would also continue, Ortega said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
The MTV Movie and TV Awards were held recently in Los Angeles, California. One of the surprising winners? Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The 86-year-old judge was named the best real-life hero by supporters voting online. Ginsburg's opinions often match those of liberal thinkers. This week, however, she agreed with one of her conservative colleagues on a case. Ginsburg and Justice Neil Gorsuch argued that state and federal governments cannot put a person on trial twice for the same crime. The issue has received attention because of a situation involving people who used to work for U.S. President Donald Trump. The federal government has found some of the individuals guilty of crimes. If Trump pardons them, observers have asked, can state governments later put them on trial for the same violations? The other seven justices on the U.S. Supreme Court said yes. Although Ginsburg did not win the majority's support for her position, her willingness to think independently has often won her praise. Last weekend, it won her an award from people who watch TV and movies. Ginsburg did not appear personally at the event, but as a winner, she joined actors Elizabeth Moss and Brie Larson. The two were recognized for their performances in the TV show The Handmaid's Tale and the superhero movie The Avengers. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Reagan Bird tries to complete her school homework every night, but the high school student in Hartford, Connecticut, uses her mobile phone because she does not have a computer or internet at home. Smartphones can connect to the internet, but they have small screens. Bird has a hard time switching between websites and messages sent from friends. She says she tries to write school papers on her phone, but when there are internet connectivity problems, she writes them by hand, she told the Associated Press. The AP studied information from the U.S. Census and found that nearly 3 million students in the United States did not have internet at home. That is about 17% of all U.S. students. 18% of students do not have home access to broadband internet. Nearly all American students have access to computers and the internet in their schools. But at home, the cost of internet service and sometimes the lack of availability create problems in rural areas and even cities. Some call the problem the homework gap.
Until a few years ago, Reagan's school gave every student a laptop equipped with an internet hotspot, providing them with internet. But the money for the program ran out. School districts, local governments in Connecticut, and others have tried to help. Districts put wireless internet on buses and created hotspots. Many communities made lists of restaurants and other businesses with Wi-Fi places where children are welcome to come and do their homework. Some students study in the parking lots of schools, libraries, or restaurants, wherever they can find a signal. Another option for communities is to provide access through unused television frequencies. The Hartford Public Library plans to try that next year.
The National Center for Education Statistics suggests that students with home internet get better scores in reading, math, and science than ones who do not. The homework gap can hurt the poor and minority students, creating barriers to their education. Janice Fleming Butler is an activist who has researched barriers to internet access in Hartford. She said it is a big injustice for minority students not to have equal access to the internet. Susan Johnston is an English teacher in Hartford. She said using paper and chalkboards is not a good idea. She thinks students really need to learn to use technology because it's not going away. The U.S. Department of Education gathered statistics in 2017 and released its findings in May. It found that the number of households without internet has been getting smaller, but 14% of homes in city areas and 18% of homes in rural areas still lack internet connections. About 33% of homes with school-aged children that do not have internet say money is the reason. A commissioner at the Federal Communications Commission, Jessica Rosenworcel, called the homework gap the cruelest part of the digital divide.
In rural northern Mississippi, home internet is not available for some, whether they can pay for it or not. Sharon Stidham takes her four boys to the school library at East Webster High School. Her husband works there, so they can use the internet for schoolwork. A cell phone tower can be seen through the trees from their home, but the internet signal does not reach their house. A third of the 294 households in Mabin, Mississippi, have no computer, and close to half have no internet. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Ann Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Kennedy, a Democrat, defeated Republican Vice President Richard Nixon in one of the closest elections in United States history. He took office in January 1961. After 3 months, Kennedy faced a major foreign policy failure. On April 17th, armed Cuban exiles tried to invade Cuba, less than 150 kilometers from the American state of Florida. They had been trained by the Central Intelligence Agency. Their goal was to overthrow the island's communist leader, Fidel Castro. In 1959, he and his guerrilla forces had overthrown Fulgencio Batista, the president who was supported by the United States. The exiles came ashore at Cuba's Bay of Pigs. Most were killed or captured. The last administration, under President Dwight Eisenhower, had planned the invasion, but Kennedy had approved it. After the failure, some Americans again wondered if the 43-year-old president had enough experience to lead the nation. In May 1961, Kennedy went to Paris and met with French President Charles de Gaulle. Kennedy visited France with his wife, Jacqueline, who spoke French and had studied there. In June, Kennedy met in Vienna with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Khrushchev did not want to compromise on any issue. He threatened to have the East Germans block all movement into and out of the Allied-controlled western half of Berlin. In November, the East Germans, with Soviet support, started building the Berlin Wall to separate East and West. President Kennedy quickly announced a large increase in American military forces in Germany. Less than a year later came the Cuban Missile Crisis. On October 22, 1962, President Kennedy made an announcement to the American people.
This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. Upon receiving the first preliminary hard information of this nature, last Tuesday morning at 9 a.m., I directed that our surveillance be stepped up. And having now confirmed and completed our evaluation of the evidence and our decision on a course of action, this government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail. The characteristic of these new missile sites indicate two distinct types of installations. Several of them include medium-range ballistic missiles capable of carrying a nuclear warhead for a distance of more than 1,000 nautical miles. Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States, in Central America, or in the Caribbean area.
Kennedy had a warning for the Soviets.
It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
Kennedy and his national security advisors debated what to do about the Soviet missiles in Cuba. Should the United States try to destroy them? What if some of the nuclear missiles escaped the attack? Kennedy decided to use a naval blockade. He called it a quarantine to prevent any more Soviet ships from reaching Cuba. There were tense negotiations with the Soviets. Khrushchev demanded a promise that the United States would not invade Cuba. Kennedy agreed and did so publicly. Secretly, he also agreed to another demand. He promised that the United States would remove its Jupiter missiles based in Turkey after the crisis was over. The Cuban Missile Crisis lasted 13 days. It raised fears of a nuclear war, but it ended peacefully when the Soviets agreed to remove their missiles from Cuba and turn their ships around. But the Cold War continued. In Asia, the Kennedy administration tried to fight communism in Vietnam by increasing the number of American military advisors there. The United States and the Soviet Union did make some progress on arms control. In 1963, the two nations agreed to ban tests of nuclear weapons except underground. Kennedy also had to deal with domestic issues, including discrimination against blacks. His brother Robert was Attorney General, the nation's top law enforcement official. The Justice Department took legal action against states in the South that violated laws on voting rights. The administration also supported a voter registration campaign to sign up more black voters. Robert Kennedy repeatedly called on National Guard troops to protect blacks when they tried to register to vote or attend white schools. President Kennedy said the situation was causing a moral crisis in America, He decided it was time to propose a new civil rights law that would guarantee equal treatment for blacks in public places and jobs. Congress did not pass a wide-reaching civil rights bill until 1964. By then, Kennedy was no longer president. In November 1963, he traveled to Texas. He hoped to settle a dispute in the Democratic Party in that state. The dispute might have affected his chances for re-election in 1964. Kennedy arrived in Dallas in the late morning of November 22nd. The president and his wife were seated in the back of an open-topped car as his motorcade drove through the city. Suddenly, there were gunshots.
Bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The motorcade raced to Parkland Memorial Hospital, but doctors could do little to save his life. This was how television newsman Walter Cronkite reported the news.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Police quickly arrested a suspect. Lee Harvey Oswald worked in a building near where Kennedy had been shot. People had seen him leave the building with a gun. Lee Harvey Oswald was a man with a strange past. He was a former United States Marine. He was also a communist. He had lived for a while in the Soviet Union and had tried to become a Soviet citizen. He worked for a committee that supported the communist government in Cuba. Police questioned Oswald about the shooting of President Kennedy. He told them he did not do it. After 2 days, officials decided to move him to a different jail. Oswald was being led by two police officers. Suddenly, a man stepped forward. There was a shot. Oswald fell to the ground. Television cameras broadcast the events live. The man who killed Oswald was Jack Ruby. He was a nightclub owner in Dallas. He said he shot Oswald to prevent the Kennedy family from having to live through a trial. A commission investigated the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren, led the investigation. In its report, the Warren Commission said that Lee Harvey Oswald had acted alone. It said there was no plot to kill the president. Many Americans never accepted that finding. Some blamed Fidel Castro or the Central Intelligence Agency. Others blamed organized crime. President Kennedy was buried in Arlington National Cemetery across the Potomac River from Washington. An eternal flame burns night and day by his grave.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.